Bonsoir tout le monde.
Merci d'être venus si nombreux et avec tant d'enthousiasme à cet événement de médias at McGill. Je m'appelle Marc Raboy et je suis titulaire de la chaire Beaverbrook en éthique, médias et communication de l'Université McGill. L'événement de ce soir est sans aucun doute un des plus importants que Media at McGill a organisé ces dernières années. Depuis son entrée remarquable dans l'espace public au mois de septembre dernier, le mouvement des indignés a mobilisé l'énergie des milliers et a captivé l'imagination des millions de personnes à travers le monde entier et à travers les cultures. On se rappelle de l'affiche iconique de Adbusters, le groupe canadien de sensibilisation aux médias, qui a allumé l'étincelle pour lancer ce mouvement de protestation massive contre les inégalités sociales et économiques faisant partie intégrante du système capitaliste mondial. Une affiche montrant une danseuse perchée sur le taureau de la Bourse de New York et le mot d'ordre « Occupy Wall Street, September 17th, bring tent ». Le mouvement s'est inspiré d'une vaste série d'événements ayant eu lieu depuis l'effondrement de la bourse en 2008, dont le printemps arabe de 2010 et le mouvement des indignados espagnols de 2011. Mais n'oublions pas le fil conducteur qui lie ces manifestations à leurs antécédents historiques, depuis les grèves ouvrières des années 30, les mouvements de décolonisation des droits civiques des jeunes et des femmes des années 60, la montée d'un courant mondial à la recherche d'une autre mondialisation des années 90 et 2000, les mouvements démocratiques qui ont marqué ces dernières décennies un peu partout à travers la planète. Ces liens, ainsi que les racines et les conséquences du mouvement des indignés, exigent qu'on s'y interroge. Et nous sommes ravis de faire notre part, si modestement que ce soit, pour favoriser cette interrogation ce soir. Dans un instant, je vais céder ma place à mon collègue, le professeur Darren Barney, titulaire de la chaire de recherche du Canada en technologie et citoyenneté de McGill, qui sera l'animateur de la soirée. La conférence ainsi que le panel se dérouleront en anglais, mais lors de la période des questions, soyez à l'aise pour intervenir en français. La traduction libre sera disponible selon les besoins pendant la période des questions. I won't repeat what I just said in English because from here on, the evening will unfold in English. And now I'm very happy to announce that our keynote speaker, Chris Hedges, has landed and is in a car on his way here. His flight landed at 5:45 p.m., only 4 hours late from New York. And we expect him to be ready to deliver his speech around 7 p.m. Now, as you know, the evening was planned to unfold in two parts, with the keynote lecture followed by a panel discussion. And happily, we have a panel here, and we're going to reverse the order of proceedings. We will begin with the panel. And when Chris Hedges arrives, as I say, around 7 p.m., we will have the keynote speech, and then we will have more discussion afterwards. And I can also say that although the event is called to end at 8 p.m., we don't have to give up the room at 8 p.m. We can stay a bit longer if necessary, depending on how things unfold. And finally, I would also like to remind you that there is a book table outside with several books by Chris Hedges that you might want to have a look at on your way out later this evening. Thank you very much. Have a good evening. Darren Barney.
Thank you very much, Mark, and thank you all for coming, and welcome on this stormy night. I'll just say a few words before introducing our panelists about how this discussion, this part of the evening, will go. I will be asking a question of each of our panelists, and they'll respond to that question, and then I'll invite the other panelists to to respond to that, to the previous panelists' response or to the question itself based on their own experience and reflections concerning the Occupy movement and related issues. And we'll proceed that way. And then depending on how it's looking with Chris Hedges' arrival, we'll either right thereafter proceed to Chris Hedges' talk to be followed by a question period, or if it looks like Chris is going to be a little bit more delayed, we might open up the floor sometime at the end of the panel portion to questions from all of you at that point as well. So we'll just play that by ear and see how it goes. So now I'd like to introduce our panelists. To my left is Anna Fagenbaum. Anna Fagenbaum is an assistant professor of communications at Richmond, the American International University in London in the United Kingdom. She helped set up the art working group Occupy LSX and is currently involved in Occupy Hackney, a local group of Occupy protesters that are linking up with existing community organizations and solidarity networks in her neighborhood. She was also involved in the Occupy London camps. She's currently working on a collectively authored book, Protest Camps, Imagining Alternative Worlds, which is due for publication in 2013. She's a member of the Occupy Research Network, and I must add, a graduate of the doctoral program in communication studies at McGill University. To Anna's left is Patrick McCurdy. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Ottawa. His research concerns issues of media, protest, spectacle, media strategies of social movement actors. He received his PhD from the Department of Media and Communication at the London School of Economics and Political Science in 2009 for his work entitled I Predict a Riot, Mediation and Political Contention, Dissents Media Practices at the 2005 Glen Eagles G8 Summit. His work has been published in several academic venues, and he too is working with Anna and others on the book Protest Camps, and I should mention that you can follow that project at protestcamps.org. To Patrick's left is Nathalie Desrosiers. Nathalie Desrosiers is the general counsel for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. She was born here in Montreal, studied law at the University of Montreal, received an LLM from Harvard, clerked at the Supreme Court of Canada, and practiced for several years in Ontario before becoming the president of the Law Commission of Canada from 2004 to 2008. After that, she became dean of civil law at the University of Ottawa and then was appointed general counsel to the CCLA in 2009. She's been a tireless advocate on behalf of civil liberties in Canada, including recently during the G20 summit in Toronto, where she joined 50 other lawyers in the streets to observe and record civil rights abuses, taking down badge numbers, exposing rights violations to the media. More recently, Nathalie and the CCLA have been involved in monitoring police evictions of Occupy camps from public spaces across the country. Please join me in welcoming them this evening. And now for our discussion. Anna, I'm going to put the first question to you. One of the interesting things about the occupations was their ability to articulate what we might call global or even universal systemic and structural critiques of contemporary capitalism with intensively local situations, intensively local conditions and alternatives. It's also the case that the occupations were simultaneously local in organization but transnational in reach. And my question to you is, what can we learn from the occupations about contemporary social and protest movements? And in particular, what mattered more, the camps or the network, the general assemblies or the streaming video, the working groups or the Tumblr site?
I might have to do an actual mic check. Are these on? Yes. Okay. So I've kind of taken Darren's question, and I'm going to focus on thinking about what it is that's important about the local site of the camp, and then what it is that I see as being really important about that broader network, and then kind of link that into where some things I think are interesting in what's happening now that kind of reverses the network into the and the local. One of the reasons I think that it's really important that these were protest camps that happened in physical spaces in urban centers, and often in urban centers that are really high traffic areas, is because that's how strangers meet, and that's how all different kinds of people come together and all different kinds of ideas and ideologies converge. And I don't think it's surprising that we see in talking to participants, in reading the writing of participants that took part in these camps, and I know there are still a few camps on the go, is this language about kind of intensity and connection and energy, as well as frustration and anger, and these really big, really kind of intense feelings and emotions. And I think that because this is a physical site, those emotions are really, really big. And I think that's really important, because I think that transformations in consciousness are really linked to spaces of high intensity and to being challenged and to being confronted by that which is different from us, and the way that pulls or turns the question back on us and makes us look at ourselves differently and makes us look at the world differently. And I don't think that we would have seen that happen if these camps weren't physical spaces that existed over time. Of course, the network is also really, really important. And I do think you can also have transformative moments in mediated situations, so from watching a live stream or engaging in a back and forth debate in a forum. I think that you can, of course, have political transformations. I just don't think they happen with the same frequency or the same intensity. But I wouldn't rule that out by any means. But of course, that network is also really important. And a lot of the projects that came out of Occupy, there are things that were going on as satellites to the camp. So a lot of the media work was not necessarily done at the base of the camp, but in sort of, you know, going back and forth between office spaces and the camp. A lot of the kind of Occupy design stuff we saw was happening both in spaces of the camp, but also in other kinds, places where there was more electricity and, you know, computers and so forth. So I think those kinds of satellites are also really important to sustaining the network, as well as this kind of incredibly viral media presence. And if you look at some of the infographics of how Occupy circulated on Twitter or through Facebook, I mean, they're astounding. I don't know if Patrick remembers the actual stat. It was something like 2.8 million retweets in 70 days for Occupy. And I think, you know, that's really profound of a thing for a social movement to happen in such a short period of time. And I think now that the majority of camps have been evicted, there is a visibility that is lost. And according to the media, of course, everything's dead, because the media likes to declare things dead all the time. And I think that it's important to remember that these things are still ongoing. Working groups are meeting, GAs are happening, and I'm sure we'll hear a bit more. You can get some details from campers who are here if you're interested in that. And I think that it's important to think about kind of how these infrastructures then get maintained in the network when the camp disappears. So that's sort of a kind of structural level. I also think that the network is bigger than just where the live streams go, and this idea that there's the camp and then there's the supporters who are watching in the media, because I think that the network of Occupy also includes what we might think of as the reflective network. So all of the people who have taken the time to tell Occupy how stupid it is and how worthless it is, and to lodge these critiques, whether they're critiques that are coming from within or with outside the movement context, they're all part of this reflective network of Occupy. If you're thinking about it and you're taking the time to comment about it and you're in a discussion about it, it's in you, it's occupied your imagination. And I think that's really important. So Occupy is both, you know, the camps, and it's this larger media network, and it's this layer of criticism and comment, and that kind of surrounds it. And so to me, that's sort of the network of Occupy reflection. Should I end there? Time. Okay. The one other thing that I think I'd like to kind of point out in this relationship between the local and the network is one of the things that's kind of happening now in a lot of cities, and what following the lead, but interestingly resonating with what's happened in Greece and Spain, is that Occupy is going kind of even more local into neighborhoods. And so in Montreal, you have Occupy the Neighborhoods. And in London, I'm not actually sure how many there are. I know there's Occupy Hackney, which is my neighborhood. And I think that this is a really, really great move, and especially when it's being networked into existing local struggles and local community groups. And I just want to talk just for a minute about my experience in Occupy Hackney to kind of link back to this idea of what Occupy Now is, or can be. It's many things. And that's kind of, so I became involved in Occupy Hackney after I had, for various reasons, kind of left working in the main camp at St. Paul's. And I got a call out a couple weeks after that from people who I had done organizing with after the riots in the UK, which hit my neighborhood quite hard, and where I'm in Hackney were really a response to police brutality in the neighborhood and to racial targeted violence, and to the closure of youth centers and kind of cuts that were happening. And so we organized in a network called Give Our Kids a Future, and in 4 days got 3,000 people to march through our neighborhood. And what was really interesting to me about this in terms of thinking about the possibilities for really local community neighborhood solidarity is that the call for this organizing team came out from the Kurdish groups in the neighborhood. And for those who are following that situation, Kurdish are coming from kind of very hostile context. And a lot of them are socialists as well. And so they put links out, and they got to they kind of contacted the anti-cuts people. The anti-cuts people contacted the socialists. Then the socialists like contacted the climate change activists. And so we found ourselves in this really interesting, diverse network of kind of community organizers that had never before kind of encountered each other in these spaces. And so this call came out for Occupy Hackney started, and from people who'd been in the Occupy camps. And then I got it from people who I'd organized with this group with, and I thought, hey, this to me is what feels right now, because this is where I'm situated. I'm not just part of a gentrifying class. I'm not just a transient. I can use these kinds of skills and resources that I have and really respond to the things that are going on literally around me. And I think a lot of people in Occupy that are involved in that maybe have left these main camps are still really actively working in these other kinds of like even more local sort of networks. And then to me the question is, do we do that work under the banner of Occupy, and do we link it up using that kind of broad-based term, or do we take this as the Occupy moment and kind of grow from there? And maybe we don't need to hold on to that term, maybe we do. I don't know. That's the question that the group of people I'm working with right now are asking ourselves, and I'd be curious to hear if other people are asking that question and how they're kind of feeling about that as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Would either of you like to respond to anything you heard in Anna's? Please go ahead, Natalie.
Well, I particularly enjoyed the idea of occupy your imagination, because I think the difficulty, or at least the connections between the local and the national or the international, is very interesting to analyze from a civil liberties point of view. Because what does it do, it does occupy the legal work of different people across the land. I'm going to talk about Canada, and it created, strangely enough, two tensions for us. Number one is you had a competition of who were the political savvy mayors. Who were the democratic mayors? The ones who you know, welcomed, supported, negotiated if there was an issue, you know, send the right message. And then suddenly, you know, so you have the local demanding of their mayors, you know, what will be the image of our city to the world as a political entity? Are we democratic or are we anti-democratic? And then you had this switch. And I remember we were writing to each mayor suggesting, and I think the part for us was, which was interesting, was to say, well, look how nice this guy has been, you know, like take model to this. And then there was a switch where it became a competition between the mayors as to enough is enough. And then it was the competition of almost the who had the, you know, the most testosterone to do something. So then for us now, so that's my analysis of how it created different tensions on the local and the network and the local. So it create, and then the second, it's for the civil liberties movement. It was how organized are we to actually do work like this? And I think we learned that we were not as well organized as we thought, you know. And so next summer, next spring, presuming that maybe you know we'll be better because there is some ways in which we know that we have to think about capitalizing both on the value of the network, but the local, you know, trying to imprint the local. So,
For me, I guess if we think about this, I would think it would be a mistake to argue one is more important than the other, the local or the network, because the local is the network, and then the network sort of can expand. Obviously, if we think of the local as the physical, the ability to meet in a space, that's incredibly important in order for us. But at the same time, the network and it provides a means for connection. At the same time, the network provides the means for, you know, let's face it, it's a privilege to be able to sort of occupy a physical space and to participate in a camp. There's a lot of people who don't have the resources, who either are afraid for the job, can't afford the ability to not occupy. So the network provides a means for people to do that. So those who can't risk losing their job. And in fact, to me, again, you look at this we're talking about this today in our workshop, the Tumblr site, which is, you know, we are the 99%, which allowed people to use sort of the network, use social media, use the internet to tell their stories and connect. And to me, that is one of the most sort of amazing things to have come out of the movement. So certainly the movement exists both in a physical space and also through the network, through local connections, through its media representation, and also through connections globally. So I would sort of see both of them as combined and both as equally important.
Thank you very much. I guess I'm going to try to follow up a little bit before I go to the next prepared question. One of the things that Anna said that really stood out to me about the specificity of the camps being in physical spaces had to do with also the designation of high traffic areas as very significant, and as you put it, spaces where strangers meet, and how significant that was to the physical manifestation of the local camps. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about both of those dimensions, that is to say, why visibility in high traffic areas was both so important, and perhaps one of the reasons for some of the kinds of police actions that we saw, but also this characteristic of this kind of urban character of the camps, such that they became places where strangers could meet and engage with one another in a way that perhaps was not possible via other types of mediated situations.
Okay, great. I'm going to often use London as the example because that's the situation that I know, and leave it to you guys to tell us about what it was like here for those of you who are at Occupy Montreal or other occupies. So I think being in high traffic areas is important for a number of reasons. A main one being that you can't ignore something that is real big and people are walking through it all the time. Like, people are going to start to look, especially when it doesn't go away and when it's taking up quite a bit of space. Right? So that just as a tactic, be big, take up space, stay there. It's a good tactic, right? It draws attention. It also turns spaces that are either supposed to be public. I've heard some really interesting things about the laws around public parks in Montreal and what you are and are not allowed to do in them and who is and is not allowed to be in them. So here it sounds like, in particular, turning making a park that's supposed to be public and actually using it as the public is a really also good and important tactic. And in London, where the St. Paul's camp was, I mean, it's made this big deal that it was, you know, this cathedral. But what really that courtyard is a bunch of places for business people to eat lunch and for tourists to come and pay something like £15 to go inside this cathedral and for them to eat lunch. Like, basically, it is a giant courtyard to walk through, look at a cathedral, and eat lunch. So having a protest camp there really transformed it from a space for consumption into a space for kind of political conviviality and for strangers to meet. And I think because of, you know, a lot of these Occupy camps were in these kinds of high traffic areas, and areas where, though the primary purpose was for kind of, you know, as spaces for consumption, they're also public kind of public highways or places people pass through when going somewhere else. You had all sorts of people in the beginning, people just seeing it that were, you know, not necessarily coming there on purpose, but they would stop and they would kind of talk to campers. And then you had people coming on purpose to see what was going on. In London, it was really interesting because all the people that were coming to see the cathedral would talk to you. People that worked in those local businesses would talk to you, and then the people who came specifically for the camp would talk to you. And I'm sure if you talked to different people from different camps, they'd have various versions of that same kind of junctures. And I think there is something about, I'm not sure how to capture it, because to me it was, you know, I'm not, you know, but there's just something about that, especially those first week or two of these camps, from my experience and from people I've talked to, where it was just like, people just talk to each other in a way that they don't usually. And that I was reading again this thing that I wrote from being there in the early days, and I was talking about how, you know, in London, I normally, especially in London where people, they don't chat so much. And you know, the only times that I would talk to strangers is if I was purchasing something from them, right, over a counter, or if I was, you know, putting my bus ticket in wrong or something and needed clarification. Those kinds of things happen to me a lot. It was just really an incredible thing, I think, especially for those of us who live in these big urban cities where it's rush, and you know, head down and me first and push you out of the way, to have this space where something really, really different was happening. And I mean, it taught me a lot about not judging people by how they look, and these really basic lessons. You know, it was like relearning those kinds of lessons.
Thank you. All right, Patrick, your turn. In his speech at Occupy Wall Street, Slavoj Žižek warned activists not to fall in love with themselves, by which I think he meant that success can be a curse. Now, despite the mainstream media's failure in its coverage of the occupations, failure that took the form of its lazy obsession with mocking the movement for its apparent lack of leaders and its lack of prepackaged demands, right? Despite that failure by the mainstream media, and partly because the movement did such a good job of covering itself, right? It's already achieved the status of being a kind of spectacular event. Occupy has started to crop up as a brand for things that have very little to do with the goals or practices of the movement. And at gatherings such as this, we spend more time talking about the movement in the abstract than we do talking about or acting upon the structural inequalities of wealth and power that the movement has called to our attention. And so my question is this: can the Occupy movement survive its representation?
I guess this, to start, this obviously it raises the question, representation by whom, right? Today in our workshop, we talked a bit about sort of media representation, mainstream media representation, and its challenges, especially dealing with tabloid journalists who are out to tell a specific story. But we also showcased some amazing sort of citizen and community journalism outfits, such as the Montreal Media Cooperative, as well as the Occupy Montreal Journal, right? So this is sort of an activist-based media where there, I would like to think the representation is more grassroots and more sort of real than what you will encounter in the mainstream media. At the same time, to me, again, I said this in my other response, but I think that the Tumblr sort of We Are the 99% sort of really sort of captures that spirit of the movement. But based on that, let me change gears for a second and talk a bit about sort of hot dogs and sausages. And it seems a bit weird, but there's an advertisement doing the rounds on TV right now. I saw it again in French and back at my hotel. It's playing in Ontario. And some by Maple Leaf Foods. And Maple Leaf Foods right now, they're using the guitar riff from Buffalo Springfield for What It's Worth, which I always thought the title was actually, you know, there's something happening here, but it's that song. And while it wasn't originally written as a protest song against the Vietnam War, it became sort of one of like the sort of songs which sort of captures the spirit of resistance. And now that song is used to sell sausages, right? And so it's something like, my point is that the commodification of dissent is something which has always plagued consumer capitalism, and it's something that all social movements face. Within the Occupy movement, we can think of Jay-Z, who sits at the top of the highest paid sort of hip-hop's rich list, okay? In 2011, he made $37 million. His t-shirt company put out, I forget what it's called, doesn't matter what the hell it's called, put out a t-shirt which said, "Occupy all streets," right? This t-shirt, not one penny from those sales went back to the movement, right? So again, you're looking at this sort of like very sort of, I think it's a shameful sort of commodification of dissent. You can look at instead street artists like Shepard Fairey, who put out lots of free art, and recently he was the person who made the Times Magazine cover of the protester. He recently put the proceeds from that back into the movement. So again, you can see that part of the challenge are the forces for commodification. I mean, part of the other challenge is the fact that I think there's other trinkets with Occupy branding, certainly. And it reflects, I think, in our day and age, we can no longer experience something without that act of consuming it. So if we're going to watch the Super Bowl, we need to be able to watch the Super Bowl with the Super Bowl branded nachos, the Super Bowl beer, and try and sort of relive and emulate the parties we see advertised in our experience of watching this big game. So to me, it's a challenge that movements always face, and it's a challenge that, you know, Adbusters has been trying to sort of contradict and sort of make explicit. In terms of sort of the Occupy movement surviving its own reputation, and I guess in the spirit of Zizek's comments, I personally think that the best thing that could have happened to the Occupy movement was to be forcibly uprooted and evicted. The movement was never about occupying a lawn. It was never about occupying a sidewalk, but it was about occupying an idea. Right? It was about occupying an idea which is dangerous, an idea which is dangerous to the established order, and an idea which can be lost, which is inevitably lost in the daily struggles of trying to stay warm, trying to sort of make consensus work. So the eviction is the evictions, in some senses, I think, have sort of galvanized occupiers. Provide a narrative for us and people to organize under, and has bought time to sort of rescue itself and come out in the spring.
Thank you very much. I'm going to throw that over to Natalie because of the very provocative conclusion that you reached, Patrick. Patrick claimed that the best thing that could have happened to the Occupy movement was the forcible evictions, and of course, the forcible evictions was something that the CCLA was particularly concerned about. So I'm wondering how you respond to a statement like that. It seems to me Patrick's point is that the forcible evictions confirmed the dangerousness of the movement, confirmed the kind of way in which its core message goes to the heart of the way we organize society. And I wonder what, from a civil liberties perspective, you might have to say about that.
But in a way, when you are a civil liberties organization, what you worry about is that the evictions will be done in a way that's going to be harmful to people. You know, so we have the basic concerns about, you know, police brutality, and if you have police brutality, then you don't want impunity, and you know, so it brings an entire new framework of accountability that is long, painful, and often unsuccessful. So you know, for us, we kind of, because if you're the Civil Liberties Association, you're neutral as to the choice of whether Occupy wants to stay there longer, move out on its own, but if they're going to be evicted, it has to be lawful and it has to be done according to the law. So we come at it from that point of view. Certainly, I think our concern were that it's never, you know, despite all the communication of dissent and so on, that, you know, we're always concerned that this may develop bad habits in police officers or something like that, you know. So you want to be careful that it's done according to law, because there will be other groups, there will be other movements, and whatever we are tolerating here will be reproduced. So that's in that context that we're approaching this. So yes, it's a stance of neutrality, I would say.
I'll say something I was going to bring up later, but I think it's fitting now. And just going back to this Zizek quote of not falling in love with ourselves, and I think that is really important, but I think also important is not falling in love with failure or with the sense of our failure, and remembering that capitalism loves failure. And it loves the language of failure used on us. For example, you know, you don't have a job, you're a failure, you're poor, you're a failure. You didn't learn the way you were supposed to, you are a failure. And, you know, in particular, capitalism, you know, the corporations, the career politicians, certainly the police, want Occupy to fail. They want the movement to fail. And I think it's really important that for whatever our very valid critiques are about some of the things that we haven't figured out, and for some of the both internal problems and issues around representation of the movement, I don't think we want to make it easy for them to say that we have failed. And so just keeping that in mind as well.
Thanks very much. Now to Natalie. And I'm going to refer here to our absent guest, Chris Hedges. In some remarks that he made recently about the National Defense Authorization Act in the United States, which is a piece of legislation that empowers the military to detain and question citizens suspected of terrorism domestically. In some remarks that he made about that, Chris Hedges has speculated that one of the reasons that the president signed it, despite opposition from key figures in the national security establishment, was that corporate elites in the United States are worried that the Occupy movement is an expanding threat to their interests, and that local police can't necessarily be counted on to secure private property and contain what could be escalating protests against economic justice in the coming months. If he's right, and we can expect continued and even escalated protests along the lines of the occupations, and now I'm asking you particularly about the Canadian situation, what should we expect from police and other security agencies, and what should we demand of them and our governments in terms of the protection of civil liberties in the face of what could be growing and sustained protest and even civil disobedience?
Well, so I'll deal with the question in three ways. Number one, what can we expect? Obviously, I'm not completely familiar with everything, but I can certainly share some of the trends that we see and the things I think that we're concerned about. What should we demand? Well, I'm much better at that, and I have my list. And then I think I want to discuss a little bit an important difference between the right to peaceful assembly and civil disobedience, because it's the right to peaceful assembly, the right to freedom of expression is protected and is subject to reasonable limit justified in a free and democratic society. So, but it's not because it's prohibited by a bylaw that it's necessarily that you know, to continue to occupy the site or to walk or to do is civil disobedience. Some of the bylaws can be challenged because they unfairly limit freedom of expression and so on. So you don't get to civil disobedience until there is clarity that indeed you're on the other side of the law. Now, that's the theory, because in practice, I think what does happen is there is a way in which the framing of what's going on has been about how important it is that bylaws be observed. You know, I think that what the counter media strategy was about playing at the fear of disorder, very deep, and so that created a sense in which what the police were told to do was presented as being the upholder of the rule of law. You know, nobody can sleep in the park. Why can't, you know, next year, why can't I just not pay my fee to go to Algonquin Park? Why can't I just sleep in the park? Yeah. So there was this thing about saying, I want the law for everyone. So Mic check.
We're talking about media control here and dissemination of information. The media team from Occupy is trying to film the event. We're just told that we're not allowed to film. And I'd like your comments on that.
Why not?
Who has the answer to that?
In general, how about controlling information and not allowing people to actually film in order so that many more people who are not able to come here to have access to this discussion and debate we're seeing?
Sure. Thank you very much for that question. All I can say is, I'm happy I didn't make the decision to disallow the Occupy Media folks to do the filming. But I think this... Sorry?
Who did?
Well, I'm just not sure, because I've been up here. So, but I will take... I would like to take our friend's direction and maybe... and ask, even in the context of the question that I've asked you, Natalie, about what we might expect going forward about control of the mediated representation of Occupy, etc.
Well,
all right. Well, as I said, I don't know why he was told he's not allowed to film, but I can't either authorize him or not authorize him to film. But if we want to put the gentleman's question to the panel, we could certainly do that about the question of the control of media representations and the circulation of information.
Right.
Let him film.
Yeah. In response to the question, is there a block? I suppose there might be one coming. We're just waiting to hear. But my sense is that we're probably moving in the direction of allowing our friend to turn his camera on. So if we just are patient for a moment, I think we might get there. All right, thank you very much for that helpful and democratic intervention. And
well, indeed, one thing that has happened is, and I say that across the look of the evaluation of police action, is that there are way more filming going on, and what we have seen is that the police are responding differently. You know, some police are getting angry and trying to shut down people who are filming them. They can't do that. And you know, we've had to take the issue up with the chiefs at time to say, "Listen, you know, there's no everybody can film somebody in the exercise of a public duty, so just let it go." But you could see how people the reaction was for some police officers to feel very on the defensive, you know, that they had no idea how to react. They were beyond their depth and felt extremely scrutinized and vulnerable, which is not something that is often, you know, they're not trained very much along these lines in terms of how to handle that sense of discomfort. So what do you get when you get a defensive police? I think you can get some serious mistakes. And I think it will be incumbent upon us to work not only on trying to make sure that indeed there is better training, a better appreciation of the value to us all of the right to peaceful assembly. It's a constitutional right, blah, blah, blah. But it's also a fundamental political right, and it serves everybody. So, you know, when I talk to police officers, I say, well, someday you'll want to walk down the streets to want better pay, you know. But there is a fundamental resistance to accepting this right. We have lots of work to do in terms of ensuring that the public is not siding all the time on the other side. You know, it's so my sense is, yes, there will be an appetite for strong action and some sort of more definitive reactions from the police. And my hope is that we have some time to ensure that the public does not go for it. You know, the public recognizes the risk associated with this. We can also work to ensure that we're well placed to to continue to work the accountability frame when bad things happen. So I think we have to. Things will get a little bit tense. My sense is, and I think we have to be prepared to do the right thing, which is to demand of our government that they observe the law. My view is that there is a responsibility to facilitate political expression, to facilitate peaceful protest. And so it goes beyond just being tolerant of it. It must go into facilitating it to allow it to reflect its message. So no shortage of work. It would be my sense for the next little while. I think it's important to recognize, you know, what we have seen, like just increased use of infiltration of groups, increased use profiling of people so that they are identified and are either harassed or monitored more. So we've seen that quite a bit.
You do? Yeah, please go ahead, Anna.
This kind of going back to something a bit different in the question about escalated protest. I just think it's also kind of important in relation to that to think about how when broad-based movements happen, one thing that happens is that bodies that aren't usually exposed to police violence and police brutality become exposed to it, and because those are often white bodies, that makes the news, and that circulates, and so we see, a lot more people see the kind of violence that the police inflict on other kinds of people every day. And I think it's also important when we think about the kinds of escalated police violence that might come if there is an Occupy Spring or some such, to also be, you know, from this moment, if our consciousness has been arisen to the fact that the police can be very violent, to join in solidarity and to support those people who face that violence every day.
Thank you. Spring seems far away, but Chris Hedges is here. So I'm going to suggest that we take advantage of him being here, and we'll move right now to inviting him up in a moment, and we'll leave our panelists sitting in their comfortable chairs, and when Chris is finished speaking, he'll join them here, and we'll open the floor to questions to Chris and all of the panelists at that time. I think that's probably the best way to proceed now. So I'm going to move over to the podium for a second. So now behind the podium, and with the authority of the podium, I'd like to say, you're allowed to film. I'm going to start with a little story. A couple weeks ago, I was in front of my house shoveling out after a snowstorm not unlike this one, and my young daughter came to the door and called out to me, "Dad, it's Ken Eshpeter on the phone." Now, Ken Eshpeter is a grain farmer from Daysland, Alberta, which has a population of 800. And he's in his late 60s, and over the last year or two, he's led the organization of a movement in the Battle River region to maintain independent, community-based grain handling alternatives to the system that's now dominated by a few transnational agribusiness conglomerates. It's a movement that's culminated in him and his neighbors commandeering some old grain elevators and establishing and operating Alberta's first and only cooperative community-based grain-dependent short-line railroad. He also runs a repertory cinema in Daysland where he screens labor films, and he's one of a number of farmers who filed a suit against the Canadian government trying to stop the government from dismantling the Canadian Wheat Board. And he drives an electric car. Now, I was shoveling, and you know what that's like. So I asked my daughter to tell Ken that I'd call him back later. She went on the phone. "No," she said. "He says it has to be right now." So I put up my shovel, and I climbed the stairs, and I peeled off my boots and my parka, and I took the phone. "Darren," he says, "have you ever heard of this guy, Chris Hedges? I'm reading his book, The Death of the Liberal Class. I think he might be on to something." Every once in a while, a public intellectual comes along who speaks the truth so plainly, with such courage and such credibility, that pretty well everyone stops and listens. Everyone from street activists in New York City to radical farmers driving their combines on the Canadian prairies, to academics who are curious about getting in on the action. Chris Hedges is that sort of public intellectual. He's a journalist whose column appears in the online publication Truth Dig. His work also regularly appears in Harper's Magazine, The New Statesman, The New York Review of Books, Adbusters, Granta, Foreign Affairs, other publications. He spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He's reported for more than 50 countries, has worked for the Christian Science Monitor, National Public Radio, the Dallas Morning News, and the New York Times, for which he was a foreign correspondent for 15 years, including 7 years as the newspaper's Middle East bureau chief. He's covered wars in El Salvador, Bosnia, and Kosovo, work which informed his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which was a finalist for the 2003 National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. In 2002, he was part of a team of reporters for the New York Times who won a Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of global terrorism,
And that same year, he won an Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. The Los Angeles Press Club named Hedges the Online Journalist of the Year in 2009 and granted him the Best Online Column Award in 2010 for his essay, One Day We'll All Be Terrorists. He's written 11 books, which along with those that I've already mentioned include What Every Person Should Know About War, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, I Don't Believe in Atheists, the best-selling American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, and most recently, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. He's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York City, and he has taught at Columbia University, NYU, and Princeton, and he currently teaches inmates at a correctional facility in New Jersey. But that's not why he's here. He's here because he puts it on the line. In 2003, shortly after the war in Iraq began, Hedges was asked to give the commencement address at Rockford College in Illinois. Referring to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, he told the graduating class, "We are embarking on an occupation that, if history is any guide, will be as damaging to our souls as it will be to our prestige, power, and security." And he went on to state that this is a war of liberation in Iraq, but it is a war of liberation by Iraqis from American occupation. As he spoke, several hundred members of the audience began booing. His microphone was cut. Two young men rushed the stage to prevent him from speaking, and Hedges was escorted off campus by security before the awarding of the diplomas. So if you don't believe it already, this could be an interesting evening. The New York Times issued a formal reprimand, which required Hedges to cease speaking publicly about the war. Remembering his father, a small-town Presbyterian minister who was a vocal supporter of the civil rights movement and a public advocate of gay rights who called for the marriage and ordination of gays at a time when such things were still unspeakable, Hedges has written of that incident as follows. "I faced a choice. I could comply with the paper's demand and pay fealty to my career, but to do so would mean betraying my dad. This betrayal was something I could not do. As I left the building knowing that my time at the paper was finished, I realized that the greatest gift my father had given me was freedom." More recently, this November, Chris Hedges co-chaired with Cornell West the People's Hearing on Goldman Sachs at the Occupy Wall Street camp in Zuccotti Park. In his statement at that hearing, Hedges said this, "There's no way to protect the ordinary citizen and the poor around the globe from the predatory activity of financial institutions such as Goldman Sachs. Since our courts refused to put on trial the senior executives at Goldman Sachs who carried out these crimes and lied to cover them up, we will." He then joined a march of several hundred protesters to the nearby corporate headquarters of Goldman Sachs, where he was arrested, along with 16 others. And just about a month ago, as I mentioned before, the National Defense Authorization Act was signed into law in the United States. Under that law, the U.S. military is authorized to indefinitely detain without trial any U.S. citizen deemed to be a terrorist or an accessory to terrorism. Calling the act a catastrophic blow to civil liberties, last week, Chris Hedges filed a suit against President Barack Obama and Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, challenging the legality of the act. Needless to say, we are very lucky they let him cross the border. The title of his talk this evening is The Way I See It. Please join me in welcoming Chris Hedges.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here in a country that produces citizens like Peter Hopperton, Eric Lankin, Adam Lewis, Leah Henderson, Alex Hundert, and Mandy Hissox. And I want to dedicate this Kevin O'Leary lecture to them. What we face is un peu en français. Bon, je parle mauvais français, non? what we face is global. My point of reference, of course, is the United States. I'm married to a Canadian, so I'm not totally unfamiliar with the peculiarities of Canada. I never thought of Canadians as being chauvinists until they crossed the border into the United States, where on every July 1st, my wife, who went to Juilliard as an actor, hangs a Canadian flag out in front of our house and makes sure to leave it up through the July 4th celebration. So there's no dispute within our neighborhood as to where our loyalties lie. I spent 20 years outside the United States, and during that time, my country underwent a coup d'etat in slow motion, a line I shamelessly steal from John Ralston Saul, but it's true. There was a decimation in the United States, and it was a planned decimation of radical and populist movements, and that is something that I speak quite extensively about in my book, Death of the Liberal Class, that goes back to try and answer the question, how did we get here? What happened? And what happened is that on the eve of World War I, we had powerful movements, anarcho-syndicalist movements like the Wobblies, the old CIO, Eugene Debs of the Socialist Party, who in 1912 in the United States pulled 6% of the vote, or 900,000 votes, that were threatening the power elite. We had over three dozen mayors, socialist mayors, and publications such as The Masses and Appeal to Reason. Appeal to Reason, which was a socialist journal, had the fourth highest circulation in the United States. And that predatory corporate capitalist class was frightened. By 1917, when it was clear that the Eastern Front was collapsing against Tsarist Russia, it raised the possibility of the Germans bringing over 100 divisions to the Western Front and perhaps decimating the British and the French. And Wall Street had lent tremendous sums of money to the British and the French, and they knew that if they lost the war, it would never be paid back. And so Wilson, who had run on the slogan, in 1912, he kept us out of the war, was pushed into the war by the bankers. There was no popular support for this war. And of course, these populist movements spoke vehemently against World War I. The decision by Wilson to enter the war, I think, was the seminal moment for popular movements in the United States. Dwight MacDonald, who's a writer I admire very much. He was briefly and disastrously a member of Trotsky's party, but kept writing things in the Trotskyite newspaper in New York that Trotsky didn't like. And so there's a famous letter Trotsky mailed from Mexico expelling MacDonald from the party. And in it, he said, everybody has a right to their own stupidities, but comrade MacDonald abuses the privilege. He really was an anarchist. I mean, he wasn't meant to be in any party. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant social critic. And MacDonald writes that those popular movements broke, that World War I was the rock on which they broke, and they never recovered. And something very important happened, which has affected us around the globe, but had its genesis in that war. And that was the creation of the first system of modern mass propaganda. that Wilson created something called the Committee for Public Information, popularly known as the Creel Commission, because it was headed by a former muckraking journalist, George Creel, who ended his career in the 1950s working for McCarthy in the House Un-American Affairs Committee hearings. And there's a very dark figure in American intellectual history named Walter Lippmann, whose book, Public Opinion, written in 1922, becomes a kind of blueprint. And in it, it gets that phrase from which Chomsky, years later, uses as the title of his own book, Manufacturing Consent. And for the first time in the history of mass propaganda, we had those who were disseminating information drawing on the understanding of crowd psychology and mass psychology as pioneered by Le Bon, Trotter, and Sigmund Freud. They understood that people were not moved by fact and reason, but by the manipulation of emotion. And the harsher measures of the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, in fact, had to be used very little because this system of mass propaganda was so effective. Edward Bernays, who's sort of the father of modern public relations, comes out of the Committee for Public Information, and his book, Propaganda, becomes one of the seminal texts that Goebbels uses when he builds the Nazi propaganda machine. It was extremely effective, and when you read those radicals who held out, Randolph Bourne, Jane Addams, one of the things that is recurrent through their writings is how depressed they are about how easily even intellectuals and radicals are seduced into the war movement. And it was the psychosis of war, permanent fear, the search for internal enemies, all of that was cemented into place. So that the moment the war was over, the dreaded Hun became the dreaded Red. And we began to disembowel American democracy. The Debs, who held out, is in prison at this point. And after the war, the harsher measures of the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act are used in the Palmer raids. They shut down the masses. They shut down appeal to reason. That's how Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman and all the others get deported to Russia. Trumped up murder charges against the Wobblies. Joe Hill gets hung under false murder charges in Utah. Big Bill Haywood has to flee the country under false murder charges. This began the decimation of popular resistance. And MacDonald writes, I think quite correctly, that all of the social and political theorists of the 19th century never grappled with this psychosis of permanent war, this constant search for the internal enemy who was subverting the state, and how effective that mechanism was for control. Now, what this did by destroying these radical movements, and let's not forget the Communist Party, which especially if you were black, was the only place where you could go and be treated as an equal. It's why figures like Paul Robeson joined the party. And most of the tactics of the civil rights movement had been pioneered long before by the Communist Party, including the sit-down lunches. All of this was transferred to the movement by Bayard Rustin, who the FBI fought very hard to keep from King. So we saw an assault against these movements. We saw a crushing of most of the radical movements, including their publications. The anarchists, by the way, the crushing of the anarchist movement, which was quite large in the United States at the end of the 19th century, was done after McKinley was assassinated by supposedly an anarchist. So we were severely weakened. Now, the role of the liberal class in any society is never to be the left. The role of the liberal class, as it's functioned, is to be the political center. It's a safety valve, so that when pressure from the bottom becomes too intense, it makes incremental or piecemeal reform possible. Karl Popper writes ad nauseum about this, and he's right. But with the destruction of those radical movements came a disemboweling of the liberal institutions in the name of anti-communism. Huge witch hunts. Maybe the last great gasp of the liberal class in the United States occurred during the New Deal, when Roosevelt created a mechanism that responded to massive unemployment and deprivation. And Conrad Black, when he writes his biography of Roosevelt, said that Roosevelt's greatest accomplishment was that he saved capitalism. And that's probably true. In the aftermath of World War II, we begin the final assault against these movements, especially with the McCarthy hearings. I taught at the University of Toronto a year ago and used to see Chandler Davis, who was one of the refugees of this. He himself went to prison for 6 months, a brilliant mathematician, hounded out like thousands of university professors in the United States. Social workers in the United States used to use their union to advocate on behalf of their clients, especially artists, directors, writers, and journalists. Great figures like I.F. Stone become pariahs, so that I.F. Stone can't even get a job with The Nation magazine and begins I.F. Stone Weekly in his basement. Institutions like the ACLU go, and of course, who is it that carries out those witch hunts? They are the most morally bankrupt. They are the careerists. They destroy Henry Wallace's vice presidential, who was Roosevelt's vice president, who ran for president in 48 because he's soft on communism. So you end up with this destruction of radical movements and perversion of traditional movements that once defended the interests of the working class. By the time you have the New Left in the 1960s, you have unions like the AFL-CIO advocating or supporting Nixon's war in Indochina and denouncing the hippies in the street. Now, that division between labor and the left essentially made the left impotent. There's some really brilliant critiques. There's a wonderful intellectual history called Exiles by Malcolm Cowley, who I used to only know because he was Faulkner's editor. But it's a really interesting book where he talks about how after the war, even the Bohemians and the Beats were inculcated with the values of the consumer society. That with the end of World War I, all of these members of the Committee for Public Information, this was a vast organization. They had their own news division, and every newspaper had to run their pro-war news, quote-unquote, news stories. Indeed, it was illegal to editorially be against the war. Appeal to Reason, the masses shut down because of that. Appeal to Reason kept publishing with pro-war editorials, and after the war, the government shut them down anyway. And it had its own film division. It was making movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin. It had speakers' bureaus. And all of these people, almost the day the war was over, went to Madison Avenue and started working for corporations. And that is when the country just became utterly awash in lies. We talk about, in the United States, about American culture, but I think that's a misnomer, because the rise of the public relations industry, the ability to make people confuse how they were made to feel with knowledge, effectively inculcated people with new values. The hedonism, the consumerism, the cult of the self, all of this stuff was implanted. And when we talk about American culture and maybe even Canadian culture, I think we're really talking about corporate culture. Our cultures were destroyed consciously by corporations who sought to instill within us consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. And it worked. And so we lost the mechanisms by which we could pressure a liberal class to respond to suffering and grievances and injustices. And then finally we lost the liberal class itself. And we saw the rise of figures like Bill Clinton or Tony Blair in New Labor. And these people spoke in the traditional language of liberalism, but betrayed core liberal values. And I pull Clinton as an example. Clinton passed NAFTA, which was the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the Taft-Hartley Act in 1948, which essentially makes it almost impossible to unionize. He deregulated the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which allowed Rupert Murdoch's News Corp and horrible corporations like Clear Channel to buy up literally thousands of radio and television stations. He allowed a consolidation of the media industry into roughly six corporate hands: Viacom, General Electric, Disney, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. And probably 90%+ of Americans see and hear almost everything filtered through these corporate forces. He ripped down the firewalls that we had, courtesy of the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act. Chrétien didn't do that. And you don't have a banking crisis. We're losing about 100 banks a year because you kept those firewalls up. Clinton destroyed welfare. One of the reasons they keep extending unemployment benefits in the United States is because, courtesy of Clinton, people have to try and survive on $143 a month and about $200 in food stamps. All of that was Democratic administration. And Clinton knew that if he carried out corporate bidding, he would get corporate money. And he did. By the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and by the time Barack Obama ran for president in 2004, he got more. And so we began this slow descent, starting in the 1970s, when, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, the country shifted from what he called an empire of production to an empire of consumption. In essence, we began to borrow to maintain both a level of consumption and an empire we could no longer afford. And all of the popular mechanisms by which we had restrained corporate forces were chipped away, eroded away, so that deregulation of Wall Street, lifting of trade barriers, the ability of manufacturing to first go over the border into Mexico, and then, of course, into China, the embrace of China's totalitarian capitalism, or Vietnam, or Bangladesh, essentially created a kind of Weimarization of the American working class. And you've seen the statistics on poverty in the United States. Roughly a third of the country living in either poverty or a category called near poverty. And these people now are spending about 35% of their income on food. But it's another thing to drive through it and see how the corporate state is hollowing the country out from the inside. I've just spent 2 years on a book with the graphic illustrator Joe Sacco. I'm writing it, and he's drawing it. I'm a huge admirer of his work. I hope you know it. Footnotes in Gaza, which he spent years on, is one of the great books on the Middle East. And so we went to these sacrifice zones, to places where unfettered capitalism had run rampant, where everybody was forced to kneel before the dictates of the marketplace. Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States and not coincidentally the most dangerous, the coal fields of southern West Virginia, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, the Sioux Indian Reservation, where the average male has a life expectancy of 48. It is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. And finally, Immokalee, Florida, in the nation's produce fields, where workers are often forced into conditions that replicate slavery, literally. They're held in bondage. They're not paid. That image or that vision of is one that is important because it's not necessarily about what happens now, but I think both of us feel it's about what's going to happen. As all of the restraints are left lifted against predatory capitalism, size of these sacrifice zones will become enormous. Until there's a passage in Orwell's 1984 about that the inner sanctum of the party is about, if I remember, you know, 4 or 5%. This sort of outer sanctum of the party is about 13%, and the rest are what Orwell calls the proles. And that's precisely what's been happening, the reconfiguration into a kind of global neo-feudalism. And none of us are immune to it, which is why these movements, such as the Occupy movements, have arisen. They've arisen because the formal systems of power no longer work. I am a huge admirer and close friend of Ralph Nader. I, in every campaign, supported him. In 2008, I wrote his speeches. I gave a talk at the University of Wisconsin, and somebody said, well, we love Nader, but his speeches are so boring. I thought they were scintillating myself. But I think nobody understands corporate power better than Nader. He's been fighting it all of his life. Nobody understands the structures of power better than Nader. And I think that the power of the public relations industry, because they're constantly polling, they're constantly doing focus groups, they're constantly taking the pulse so that political figures can recite back to you what it is you want to hear. They're extremely good at it. And when you get on the inside, the cynicism is staggering. It was a very lonely position in 2004 to support Nader with the rise of Obama, who is a brand and functioned as a brand. The meltdown of Wall Street terrified the shit out of Wall Street. They thought they'd been caught. They thought they were going to have to pay. And they put Obama up. Obama functions the same way people of color or HIV-positive models functioned for Bennington and Calvin Klein a few years ago. It allows consumers to associate a risque lifestyle and progressive politics and confuse it for an experience. And that's why Obama won Advertising Age's top annual award right after the elections, Marketer of the Year. He beat Nike, Apple, Zappos, because the professionals knew precisely what he had done. The only thing, we're watching this horrendous March of the Trolls, Republican contest. The only thing either party has to offer is fear, manufactured fear, because the superstructure of the corporate state is left untouched. Obama has carried out the policies on every substantial issue. He's carried out the policies of George W. Bush. He has served corporate interests as assiduously as Bush. We've actually seen a deterioration of civil liberties in the United States. I spent a lot of time in the New York airport today, so I was reading the Canadian news wires and saw that read the letter your Minister of Energy sent out, in which he warned he was attacking foreign money and foreign influences for activists and radical ideology. And the last line was, and they all want to, they'll all end up like Americans and try and sue. Well, if somebody just tried to sue the president, I think that was necessarily a bad idea. Normally, in a functioning democracy, the courts are where citizens go to seek redress against injustices. But it was just a window into how pervasive this corporate ideology has become. And, of course, Harper is really just a diminished version of George W. Bush, if Bush can be diminished. And unfortunately, I can't speak to the Canadian political system, although I used to know Michael Ignatieff very well when he was at Harvard. We actually went, well, we don't speak much anymore. The day of the invasion of Iraq, we were both on National Public Radio, and we each got, you know, they always balance it out, 12 and a half minutes. But I was saying why we shouldn't not go into Iraq, and Michael was, I don't know why, as a Canadian, he's sort of waving the American flag, was 12 and a half minutes as to why we should. And for me, that was just another window into a bankrupt kind of liberalism. The idea that we can impose what we consider our virtues on other people by force. This is a peculiar American ideology, this idea of regeneration through violence. It's what we carried out on the Western Plains when we, through genocide and starvation and disease, destroyed 95% of the native population in the United States. The sickness of that legacy runs deep through American society. And I think that there is a difference between Canadian and American society, and one of it is that we are a deeply violent culture. And I think Canada doesn't share that propensity to violence the way we do. Well, I mean, look at the measures. I was also reading about the RCMP infiltrating First Native communities. I mean, what always fascinates me about Canada is that you have us as an example. I mean, we're doing everything wrong. I have no idea why 10 years later you want to replicate the mess that we engender. But somehow, I don't know, it filters upwards here. I'm not sure what's wrong. This is a global movement. And I used to give talks. I don't know if maybe some of you have read some of my books. And, you know, I was pretty bleak. The fact is, unfettered capitalism, as Karl Marx understood, is a revolutionary force. It is built within it a quality of self-annihilation. Because, as Carl Polanyi, great economist, his book, The Great Transformation, is 1944, is a classic. He fled Europe with his wife, who the U.S. State Department considered to be a communist, and she actually, he taught at Columbia, she could never get a visa to the United States. She lived in Canada, and Polanyi had to go back on the weekends to be with his wife. But in the book, he writes, he actually, for an economist, uses the word sacred. He said, when a society loses the capacity for the sacred, when it commodifies everything, when human beings become commodities and the natural world becomes a commodity, it exploits both until exhaustion or collapse. And that is precisely what's happened. Corporate forces have been unleashed with no impediments, and they have commodified everything, including the ecosystem on which we depend for survival. And they will destroy it for quarterly profits. Now, this isn't a new phenomena in human history. And Ronald Wright, in his that short little book, The Short History of Progress, which is pretty smart, chronicles that. But the difference is that this time there are no new lands to exploit. There are no new peoples to conquer. This time when we go down, we're all going down. There's nowhere else to go. And if we continue to put our faith in traditional systems of power, which are corporate, and of which, of course, are run by the fossil fuel industry, as your Minister of Energy has amply demonstrated who he works for, they'll kill us. They'll kill you, and they'll kill your children. This is literally a fight for life. And I think for those of us who saw the bleakness of what was out there, I would give talks, and people would, you know, afterwards say, well, what about hope? What about hope? Well, I'm not making it up. I mean, climate, you can't make up climate science. It's there, and you have to read it, and you have to understand the crisis we're in. I don't share, I think it was Margaret Atwood who said, I don't share the mania for hope. I was a war correspondent for 20 years. And people who are very Pollyannish about their future or believe that progress was inevitable or that they wouldn't get shot because somehow they would be protected didn't live very long. I was in Sarajevo during the war. 45 journalists were killed. Dozens were wounded, including my photographer, 3 days after I got there. And there was a Swiss journalist who I had an armored car. I was with the New York Times. But other journalists, especially freelance journalists, had, we call them thin-skinned, but basically it was regular cars, thin-skinned because bullets could go through them. And a Swiss journalist used to drive across the tarmac. We were all in the Holiday Inn. The front, whole front of the Holiday Inn had been sheared off by artillery fire. So you actually had rooms on three sides, and then in some floors you could actually open the door and look out, except it was a really bad idea because the snipers were about 200 feet away. He used to drive across the tarmac, the airport, which was disputed, to a Croatian town called Kiseljak to buy cigars. And it was total machismo, which sort of informs most of war reporting. And smoked them on the way back, and the Serbs would shoot at him. And one day he spray-painted on the side of his car, "Save your bullets, I'm immortal." I mean, it's funny, except he's a cripple now. I mean, he was shot. You made an assessment of what those weapon systems were at the end of that road, and you responded accordingly. People who had a false vision of reality, who had that kind of mania for hope, couldn't cope. And I spent a lot of time in Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle, talking about celebrity culture and spectacle and how illusioned we are. We are sold across the political and cultural spectrum. This idea that reality is never an impediment to what we want. We can have everything we desire if we dig deep enough within ourselves, or we focus on happiness, or we grasp that we are truly exceptional, or we believe that Jesus can carry out miracles. But it's magical thinking. And the greatest impediment to waking up the society is wrenching them away from these illusions, these virtual hallucinations, as Derek Jensen calls them. And he's right, this culture of make-believe. And it's powerful, and it's intrusive, and it follows you everywhere. I mean, I don't own a television, and I know more crap about popular culture because of airports. I mean, there's about people I don't even want to know about, like Kim Kardashian, or that SEALs may be getting a fake divorce. I mean, I even know that maybe it's fake from Heidi Klum. I mean, this is what is just bombarded into our brains. And, of course, it becomes impossible to think. Thinking is about solitude. Thinking is about shutting out the outside world. And I think, finally, thinking is rooted in print. And that shift from a print-based culture to an image-based culture has been deeply disempowering because the people who control those images are corporations. And they're very, very good at it. So I understood, I think like Nader, that corporations know only one word, that's more. That the impediments that once had been in place to limit the destructive power of corporations had been lifted. It's how you see Canada walk away from Kyoto. And that the formal mechanisms of power were, in the words of the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin, and he wrote a great book, Democracy Incorporated, which I urge you all to read, had turned our system into something he called inverted totalitarianism, which means that it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in classical totalitarian regimes, you have a dictator or charismatic figure in inverted totalitarianism, you have a system whereby corporations pay loyalty to the Constitution, electoral politics, the iconography and language of patriotism, and yet internally have so corrupted the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. And that's where we've come. And when everybody showed up in Zuccotti Park on September 17th, I was as surprised as everyone else. I expected a backlash, but I didn't know what that backlash would look like. I didn't know, of course, when it would come, and I've covered revolutions and movements before. I covered all of the revolutions in Eastern Europe, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. And they take on a kind of life of their own. Many of us had been demonstrating and carrying out acts of civil disobedience. I used to do this with Veterans for Peace in Washington. And every time we showed up, we'd never get more than a few hundred. Everybody kept waiting for that moment. But you keep doing it because you keep alive another narrative. You keep that flame going. You know, when I was in Czechoslovakia, I was in the streets of Prague, and there were posters everywhere of a young Charles University student who, to protest the 1968 Soviet invasion of his country, had gone down to Vensela Square, lit himself on fire, and died 4 days later from his burns. Yeah, Pollock. And when his fellow students tried to march in his funeral procession, it was broken up by police. Of course, the state media never covered it. When his grave became a shrine, the state dug up his body, cremated his body, gave the ashes to his mother, told her she couldn't bury them. They did everything in their power to make him a non-person. And yet, his picture was everywhere. And 3 weeks after the fall of the communist government in Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel went to Red Army Square and renamed it in his honor. I was in Vensela Square when one of Czechoslovakia's greatest singers, Marta, what's the last name? Kubaya? Kubish? I don't speak Czech, obviously. Anyway, great singer. She had sung the anthem of protest in 1968. When Dubček rose to power, it was crushed. She became a non-person. Her recording stock was destroyed. It was never allowed to be played. Her songs were never allowed to be played on the radio. She was relegated to working on an assembly line in a toy factory. I was in Vensela Square when she walked out on that balcony, and she began to sing that anthem. And I was with a bunch of Charles University students, and they sang with her, and they knew every word as the tears ran down their face. No act of resistance is ever wasted. It keeps alive that narrative, and it makes possible a movement. So that in East Germany, you had Lutheran congregations walking through the streets in candlelit vigils every night, just a few dozen, and then suddenly one day, there's 70,000. People find the courage. They wake up, they understand, and that is the Occupy movement. That is what's happened. And it's not going away, because the only response of the state is to try to physically eradicate it. They have in Canada, they have in the United States. They've not responded to the conditions that have driven people into those encampments. If the power elite was even remotely in touch with what's happening in the United States and sought in some way to blunt the power of this movement, they would have immediately forgiven the $1 trillion in student loan. The largest debt, the largest personal debt in the country are student loan debts. And by the way, because of our Congress, even if you declare personal bankruptcy, it doesn't count for student loans. it just accrues interest. The only way to get out of your loan is if you die. And they would have responded to our unemployment, which in real terms is somewhere between 15 and 20%. When you count people who have stopped looking for work or people in poorly paid part-time jobs, most people at Walmart work about 28 hours a week, which puts them below the poverty line. And they would push through a jobs program, and they would declare a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions. But their response is to try and physically crush the movement in a concerted effort. Those first 18 encampments, and I just read that the Washington police have, there are two encampments still up in Washington, and they've told them if anybody's in there by Monday, they'll both be arrested. But everybody in those encampments will be arrested. They're going to be cleared out. This, for me, exposes how calcified, frightened, out of touch, and dead the system is. How long will it go on? I don't know. In Poland, it took 10 years of resistance. In East Germany, it took 10 weeks. And in Czechoslovakia, it took 10 days. No one knows. I was with the leaders of the East German opposition in Leipzig on the afternoon of November 9th, 1989. And they told me that perhaps within a year, there might be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. Within a few hours, the Berlin Wall, at least as an impediment to human traffic, did not exist. What happens in calcified regimes is that the pillars of those regimes weaken and fracture. And that's why nonviolence is absolutely crucial. The state wants us to respond with violence. The way to break the power of the corporate state, and certainly this has been fundamental in Zuccotti, is by reaching out to the foot soldiers of that state, civil servants, police, and reminding them who they are, the 99%, and who they're working for, the 1%. And I have seen in revolution after revolution how when decayed and bankrupt regimes are confronted with this kind of popular response, that once those foot soldiers no longer are loyal, that regime is no longer sustained. So that when Erich Honecker, in the fall of 1989, sends an elite paratroop division to Leipzig to fire on the crowd, they won't do it. And at that moment, Honecker's finished. That is the tactic. It's not to hit the pillars. It's to draw those within the pillars towards us. And that's why these people are so scared, because they know far better than you or I how gamed the system is, how corrupt it is. And the benefit of having been a New York Times correspondent is that I was on the inside of those corridors of power. And I know how fragile and frightened they are. And that's why they've responded the way they have. We are seeing the rise of a draconian security and surveillance state in the United States, and also from everything I read in Canada. The National Defense Authorization Act, for those of you who have followed it, is truly a terrifying piece of legislation. It overturns over 200 years of law and authorizes the military to carry out domestic policing in the United States. It broadens the definition of who is a terrorist. It used to be under the 2001 Act that only groups that were tied to Al-Qaeda, part of Al-Qaeda, had some kind of a role in the attacks of 9/11. Now it's groups that never even existed. The list of people who in the United States can be investigated for terrorism include people who are missing fingers on their hand, people who are hoarding more than 7 days of food in their house, and people who have weatherproof ammunition. which includes most of my relatives in Maine. It's a very short step to add to that list some of the obstructionist tactics of the Occupy movement. So we're entering a phase. I mean, George Orwell said that all totalitarian systems rule through fraud and force. And now that that fraud is being exposed, these systems, these corporate systems, are turning to the harsher and blunter measures of force. I have no doubt, having been in disintegrating societies, having covered movements all over the world, that the corporate state is finished. I don't know how long. The question is that, I guess, is how much damage they will be allowed to inflict before they are removed from power. And the climate science is terrifying. We have very, very little time left. We're already going to suffer the effects of climate change. We already are suffering from that effects. People like Jim Hansen, the chief climate scientist for NASA, say 3-4 years at the most. And the only way these forces are going to be stopped is if we are willing to put our bodies on the line. Now, going to jail is more time than I care to donate to the U.S. government. However, I think when you look, at least within my country, those voices that I regard as kind of beacons of morality, Bill McKibben or Wendell Berry, have Cornel West, have all come to that conclusion. This is the final battle. And if we don't win it, they'll take all of us down. What you're doing is not small. It's huge. It's not going to be pleasant. It's not going to be easy. But in theological terms, we have to vanquish what are, in essence, systems of death. Thank you.
This is the time we all expected to be here, but of course we got started late. So I think if anyone has to leave, we'll give you a moment to make your way out. But we're hopeful of sticking around in the room here and hearing from you, whether in the form of questions or comments. There's microphones here and there, so please feel free. I'd ask you just to be judicious and courteous, knowing that there's probably many of us who are going to have something to say, and we'll try to make as much room as possible for as many voices as we can. I'm sorry, you're suggesting that we take several questions or several first. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Thanks. All right, please go ahead.
Thank you. I just had a question regarding, all the Occupies, but specifically the Montreal one. You were mentioning before that, you know, part of our goal is to educate the social workers and the, you know, police and whatnot. At Occupy Montreal, we kind of really tried to do that and had a good relationship with the police in the city. I guess the question that I really have is, what is your take on the divide and conquer tactic? We had the 2-3 police people always there being so nice to us. And like, yeah, the fire chief saying, wow, your long house is so nice. And how can we make it safer? And they're all nice. And then you go to the meeting with the head chiefs and they're all, oh, yeah, we understand. And the next day, oh, we got to get rid of everything because, you know, the mayor decided to change his idea. And the whole idea is that we, you know, we're working with them being nice. And they send us the people that the 2 police officers that will be nice to us when it's time to get down and dirty. You know, they don't come back. You know, it's the group comes and they don't know who the 2 officers were anymore. And I don't know, I was just curious to see what your experience was with that in New York.
Thanks. We'll take a few in a row, I think, and then.
I'll take like 3 or 4, otherwise I'll forget them.
Yeah. Okay. 3 or 4. Sure. Please go ahead, sir.
The question I would like to ask is, what do you? I mean, the Occupy movement seems to have many, many people with different agendas and different programs. How can this movement itself be harnessed to have and to create change? What is their way? Are they going to be running for parliament? Are they going to be running for representations? Whatever. I mean, otherwise, it seems to be just a very diffuse group, very much like the Chartists in England, where they made a big bang in the beginning. They came with a big, I think, constitution they're going to present to parliament, and then it just evaporated, the Chartists of England, you know? Yeah. And the other thing is the question about China. There's an Occupy movement here against corporate capitalism and all this. But what about countries like China and India, where basically the population is rather apathetic and you have a new oligarchies coming up and there's nothing going on there?
All right, let me respond to those two. First, question of the police. Well, I guess that's the difference between Canada and New York, because nobody was very nice to us in New York. The Occupy movement really took off when a white-shirted inspector in New York named Anthony Bologna pepper sprayed four women who were behind those orange plastic barricades, and they didn't respond. Now, the feeling among the occupiers was that they were being provoked, and I think that's right. Up until there was any kind of media attention, so I'm talking about the first week in Zuccotti, the police were outrageous. I mean, for instance, they would, in the middle of the night, and everyone was, of course, sleeping, they would turn on their lights and their sirens, and then they would just, and Zuccotti's a really small place, and they just drive around Zuccotti to keep everybody awake. The state knows really well how to deal with violence. They don't know how to deal with this. And don't be fooled by the nice cop, bad cop. The tenor of the police would change in New York instantly when the white-shirted inspectors would show up. All the fraternizing with the occupiers would end. And, of course, we had, from the beginning, a large number of undercover cops who were infiltrating us. They were really easy to spot out. They all looked like cops with a baseball cap. And you could always tell they were cops because they were going around going, so who's the leader, do you think? Who's running this? That's how you could always tell cop. And so this woman in the medic tent, one of these cops, who he told us he was from Rollins College. He was like 30, looked like, you know, he'd come out of the Marine Corps. It was out of a bad Doonesbury cartoon. He goes over to him and goes, so who do you think is in charge here? And she goes, I am. He goes, oh, really? Well, what are you in charge of? And she goes, everything. And he goes, what's your title? And she goes, God. The point is not that these people are going to get more brutal. I did a radio show with Jesse Jackson a couple weeks ago, and he said something really interesting, which I had not been aware of. He said, every time we did a march, you know, in the civil rights movement, like in Selma, we never got very many people. He said, in Selma, we only got 200 people to go on the street. This idea that large numbers of people were willing to get arrested is just not true. It's actually a small group of people who are really committed. And I hadn't understood that about the civil rights movement. And so I think in the Occupy movement, we certainly have enough. In terms of this gentleman's question on should we run for parliament or stuff, I mean, Karl Popper in The Open Society and Its Enemies writes that the question is not how do you get good people to rule. That's the wrong question. Most people, Popper writes, who are attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama, and venal, which is Bush and probably Harper. The question is how do you stop the powerful from doing as much damage to you as possible? And that comes through movements. All of the correctives to American democracy came through movements. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists for women's rights, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, none of them achieved formal political power. And yet, until he was assassinated in 1968 in April, King was probably the most powerful political figure in the United States, because when he went to Memphis, 50,000 people went with him. And if any of you have read the memoirs about Nixon, you know, and Nader points out correctly, Nixon was our last liberal president because he passed the Mine and Safety Act, OSHA, the Clean Water Act, not because he was a liberal, but because he was scared of movements. And there's actually in some of the memoirs a scene where there's this gigantic anti-war demonstration where they've completely surrounded the White House, you know, tens of thousands of people against the war, and Nixon, to protect him, they've actually put buses all around the White House, and Nixon is like nervously wringing his hands with Kissinger at the window going, "Henry, they're going to break through and get us." And that's precisely where we want them.
Thanks, Kate. Please go ahead, and then we'll come in.
Okay. So my questions are just about your talk, Chris. So you kind of point to propaganda as sort of playing a huge role in you know, this, like, kind of downfall, I guess. And, you know, like, one, like, probably the quintessential, like, example of, like, successful propaganda would be Nazi Germany. And so my question is, I mean, you paint this picture of, like, a passive population being bombarded with information and then just following it. When, you know, at least in Nazi Germany, that wasn't the case. You know, you have to have a population that receives this information and is okay with it, which is a much scarier thought than just blaming the media. So I would like your thoughts on that. And also...
Perhaps one more.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, like the state's mechanism of creating like non-people or a non-person to sort of like erase their political effect. But at the same time, we're now seeing movements such as like Anonymous or WikiLeaks that are like based on this idea of a non-person. So how is like this notion of anonymity working to advance political subversion?
I know you're chomping at the bit, but I want to let some more people get their questions on the table too.
Yeah, my name is Philippe Landry. I used to take sailboats from Lake Champlain. I went through New York quite often. For me, it wasn't very complicated to see that 911 didn't make sense. You know, and I'm surprised that now, even the Huffington Post, which is supposed to be on the left, decided to censor Jesse Ventura because he's too close to the truth or something like that. I wonder, when will Americans step up and say clearly that this whole thing is bullshit?
Okay, thank you.
Am I clear enough?
Yeah, they are very clear. No, thank you. Very clear. Very clear. Okay, we'll take one more from this mic.
Yeah. I actually wasn't even going to ask a question, but somebody pointed out to me very clearly that there are no women asking questions, so I wasn't going to leave here without asking something. I encourage the women in here to get up and ask something. No comment. I think my question or concern is, first of all, I feel weird, awkward, height. Okay. Je veux vraiment que le monde ici, ça se peut qu'il y ait du monde qui n'ont pas compris comme tout, mais je veux au moins qu'ils prennent comme l'importance, qu'ils essayent de s'exprimer comme c'est vraiment important. Le but, c'est important. Le mouvement, c'est important. What we're doing, c'est pas juste des arts plastiques qu'on fait, puis j'aimerais que du monde s'informe. Informez-vous, je veux dire. Informez-vous. Lis des affaires sur le NDAA, the Omnibus Crime Bill. Informez-vous. Apprends des affaires, parce que c'est pour ça qu'on est là. And I guess what I want to ask is, how can we proceed with this? What can we focus on? Because I feel like we're micromanaging at this point. In the GA and stuff like that. I feel like we're really going around in circles, trying our best to organize ourselves. I would like to know what your suggestion is as to what we can focus on besides putting up tents.
Okay, I think I'll put it to the panel. Well,
let me first deal with propaganda. I mean, if you go back and look at Nazi Germany, in fact, it was quite incremental. There's a couple good books on it, The Nazi Conscience by Kuntz, and another book called Define Hitler by Sebastian Hofner. It was a very gradual process. Hitler very rarely, I think in fact three times between 1933 when he took power and 1938, spoke about the Jews, and the radical wing of the Nazi Party accused him of caving into the interests of Jewish bankers. What the Nazis talked about was moral renewal, and they were cheered on by the German churches. And their first target were not Jews. They were homosexuals. So the first book burning in May of 1933 was the Center for Sexual Science, whatever it's called in German, by Hirschfeld. All the homosexual clubs in Berlin are closed. And Kunz does a quite a good job of sort of chronicling this, so that even when Jews are targeted, Jewish veterans from the First World War are exempt. It is a very gradual process, and you see that in the United States, so that you have the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act that has a radical interpretation by lawyers like John Yoo, so that we have Jose Padilla, who supposedly was one of the hijackers who didn't make the plane, although a U.S. citizen, is held by the military in a military brig for 3.5 years without due process. This is challenged. It makes its way to the Supreme Court. Before the Supreme Court takes the case, he's transferred to a civilian court. You have, through the Authorization to Use Military Force Act, Obama interpreting that to give him the power of judge, jury, and executioner to order the assassination of an American citizen in Yemen, Anwar al-Awlaki, the cleric. Now what we're seeing with the National Defense Authorization Act is that all of that is codified into place. There's absolutely no question. And the lawyers who brought the case actually came to me because they said we need a plaintiff, a credible plaintiff, and somebody who spent as much time in the Middle East. You know, I had dinner with Abu Jihad and Yasser Arafat and traveled with the PKK in southeastern Turkey and knew all the leaders of Hamas. There's no exemption for journalists. There's nothing in there that would preclude you, if they want to, from doing this. And so these steps towards the cementing of totalitarian control are never dropped like a huge iron curtain. They are accompanied by massive amounts of propaganda, by an appeal to fear. You paralyze people through fear because of, you know, Muslim terrorists or internal enemies or Jews or whoever it is. And so I think that it is like Nazi Germany, and that it is incremental. In terms of, like, the camps, well, you know, everybody, they lost control of Zuccotti. And I don't think that was uncommon in encampments. The moment that they lost control is when they put up personal tents. Because the cops, even after the publicity, were really brutal. I mean, they'd go around at night and rip down structures, and they were constantly looking for any kind of violation that would justify an intervention. The other problem is that these encampments, and I don't know whether you went through this in Montreal, what got put upon their shoulders were the wider social problems that these encampments were not prepared to and not equipped to handle. And the cops in New York realized this really quickly and started driving homeless people down to Zuccotti Park. Now, Zuccotti ran the largest open-air kitchen in New York. It was really amazing. But all of those people came with, you know, or some of them came with substance abuse problems. And, you know, of course, in America, I don't know what you do in Canada, but we throw our mentally ill out on the street, either that or in prison. So tremendous amounts of energy were suddenly invested into maintaining the encampment, making it a safe place, which meant people staying up all night long in de-escalation teams and security teams. I have two very good friends, Zach Solomon and John Friesen, who were in the kitchen. You know, when they came in that night, they padlocked themselves around the kitchen. And it was sort of interesting because the cops, when they came in, you know, sometimes we think they know more than they do know. They weren't prepared. They didn't know anybody in the kitchen was going to do a lockdown. And it took them 4 hours when they had to go get a truck, you know, and get with the cutters for the bolts and stuff. And And, you know, John and Zach said, look, you know, we fought to defend it, but we half prayed to lose it because we'd lost control. And we've been fighting Trinity Church, this bizarre configuration of a church. It's a corporation masquerading as a church. Has $30 billion in real estate property in Manhattan, and one of its tenants is Goldman Sachs. The rector of the church, Rector Cooper, makes a salary of $1.2 million a year. His title is rector and CEO. I'm not joking, really. So they have an empty space near Duarte Square, which my friend George Packard, this crazy Episcopal bishop who I love, climbing, you may see the YouTube, him climbing in his purple robe over the fence. And they, the decision was that when they get a space, it'll be very different from Zuccotti. That everybody has to participate, complete sobriety, no tolerance for violent language, violent behavior, because in the end, this is a political movement. And it, I'm going to tell you, it hurt people in Zuccotti to come to this decision. It hurt them. It doesn't mean that people off the street are not welcome. They are always welcome, but they have to participate. This movement has to radiate outwards. It's not about the encampments. The encampments are a base by which you carry out actions. And they, you know, I was telling, I had, after Zuccotti got shut down, I had a bunch of the Direct Action Committee came to my house in Princeton, were camped out all over the floor, which I have a four-year-old kid who loved it. I mean, he was like, he couldn't wait to get down and hop on everybody. They were very tolerant, up and down on their sleeping bags every morning. But I think that there's a real decision that, you know, when we were talking, I said, you know, you have to run an encampment that is safe for my four-year-old to walk through 24 hours a day. And if it's not, then it has to be changed. And I think out of the, I mean, these were truly open societies. But in the end, you know, the configurations of the encampments when they come back have to be different. They have to be stricter. And one of the reasons that they wanted that space in Lower Manhattan on Canal and Liberty is because it actually has cyclone fencing with gates, so that if people carry out disruptive behavior or threatening or violent behavior, there's actually a way to keep them out. And unfortunately, I think that is the way we have to go if these encampments are going to make it.
Thank you. I want to, if there's anybody else on the panel that wants to respond immediately, I'd like to give you some room for that too. Otherwise, I'll go back to the questions. But
just to address the anonymous question quickly. I think it's important to just distinguish that corporations use anonymity in order to be not accountable so that they can steal from us, whereas groups like Anonymous use anonymity as tactics to give back power, and that it resonates with the Alter Globalization movement slogan, "We are everywhere." And I think it's also an invocation of the fact that that power is everywhere, and that anonymity is also a gesture that says it could be me or it could be you that are part of this movement.
Ahead, just to build on that as well, because I think it's a fantastic question. There's lots of room to explore the contrast there. I mean, you think about in a surveillance society, and anonymous tactics, they are necessary. You know, fighting networks with networks. At the same time, there still are public acts of shaming. I think of, you know, the 2003, the taking the steamrollers to crush the Dixie Chicks CDs, right? That sort of public shaming, which occurred back then. But it also still does require public and visible acts. And just simply, while I have the floor, I just wanted to actually thank Chris Hedges for his eloquent reply to Kevin O'Leary, who is obviously a psychopath, and you undressed him and you handled him fantastically. And thank you for that.
Thanks. Indeed. We'll go over to this mic over here. Please go ahead.
Yes, my question is about the concept of the public sphere. What does the eviction of the occupiers mean for the ways in which we define the public?
Okay, thank you. A couple, take a few more. Go ahead, please.
First, on the Kevin Olivier exchange that you had, you ended this interview by saying that I'm not coming back. Please don't do them the favor and keep on going back. Second, I'd like to mention something that has not been mentioned so far, and I think it's at the core of what's happening, not only this movement, but at the core of what's happening in the Western world. And I think it has to do with the disillusionment of people with the institutions and with representative democracy. And I'm saying in the Western world because this fake, in my opinion, democracy has not been established in the rest of the world for as long as in the Western world. People have become disillusioned, and I think it's the most important thing that's happening because, and I'd like your comment of all the panelists, because you still have some people that come and say maybe we should run for office and maybe we should go in parties, etc., which is okay. And usually they're over 50 or so. But young people are completely disillusioned, and I think that's very important, very, very positive, because they have started realizing, you said before, who has the power is not the right question. I agree, but I would add power, like who has the power is not the problem. Power itself and authority is the problem. And more people, and we're scared, many of us here, to say the word anarchy, because it's a bit, you know, especially in North America, it's very heavy word. But for good, for better or for worse, all these movements, and I have seen exactly the same thing happening in Greece, Spain, and Canada, were the closest thing to anarchy that has ever happened in a long, long time. So I'd like your comment on that.
Please go ahead.
Yeah. All right. I was an occupier here in Montreal. I didn't last very long. And I think I can speak for a lot of people who went down a fair bit but didn't last either, that it was getting bogged down in things other than I thought what were pertinent. And I think a couple of people have referred to it already, but I'd like to hear more. Maybe not even tonight, but I think I just want to plant the seed in everyone's minds of what I think is effective. Questioning of ourselves is to ask ourselves sort of like Chris was saying, how are we drawing people out of the towers? How are we provoking and confronting and exposing the irrelevance of the system, of the corporate system? It's they that are irrelevant, not us. So anyway, I think I kind of did it quicker than I thought I would, but thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to take one more, and then I'll invite some response. Please go ahead.
Hi. The panel touched upon the idea and the importance of the urban or the city-based symbol being a very important symbol, and obviously for any movement it is. However, do you think that the focus on the urban areas worked as a barrier against the voices of the rural area and the voices of the rural interests, which is commonly a critique of Marx? And would you say that this hurt the movement due to the rise in negative interpretations from the lower density non-urban areas being targeted by media, which was the only got, and they only got that negative interpretation from?
Thank you. Anyone?
Yeah, thank you for saying the A word. One of the things that I've been thinking about, mostly coming out of my conversations with occupiers during my time that I've been here in Montreal, is that we're using these anarchist, indigenous, and feminist processes, but yet they're butting heads with these capitalist versions and visions of democracy and equality and liberalism. And then we're wondering why the processes are not, you know, why this is happening. And I think that, again, in this idea of kind of taking the winter as the reflective time and kind of thinking about the ways that these processes of participatory and direct democracy emerge from critiques of oppression, right? And emerge from oppressed communities and our practices of decolonization. So when we use them, we also need to be engaged in those practices. We can't bring our capitalist visions of equality and we all have equal voices and then try and use direct democracy, the practices, without having this headbutt happen. And I think that anarchism, especially as it is infused with indigenous and feminist kind of reflection, is a really good tool to kind of unpack some of the problems that we've seen. And I'm sure many of you have resources, and there's a lot in the community, and you're welcome to come up and ask me about them too.
I'll tackle maybe the rural urban divide. It seems to me that the the future will demand that there'll be, and I think there will be some Occupy outside of their urban area. It's you can see it coming out. It's going to take different format, but I think you will have youth in small towns are paying attention, and they certainly are calling us with new ideas about how they don't like what's going on in their school, how they want to know more, and so on. So my sense is that the you know, I was quite, I think it does go local, petit, et puis, and then it comes back. So to me, maybe you're right that up to now it has had way more publicity in urban, but I sense that the grasp is reaching much larger.
Well, the Occupy movement is an anarchist movement. I mean, that's what it is. And centralized authority always leads to totalitarian control, whether it's communist, fascist, or corporate. You know, the early period of the Russian Revolution was dominated by Russian Soviets, which were anarchist, which is why Lenin and the Bolsheviks carry out an armed push to shut them down, because Lenin wanted centralized control. And when you centralized power among a tiny elite, they often replicate behavior. And that's why I think the utopian vision of globalization and corporatism is as dangerous as the utopian vision of communism or fascism. There's no question that these are primarily anarchist structures. I'm sure many of you have read Kropotkin, but Kropotkin for me is one of the most interesting of the anarchists, because he comes out of the natural sciences, and although an admirer of Darwin, he challenges this notion that's seized upon by predatory capitalists of survival of the fittest. He said that's completely wrong, that species that survive are species that take care of each other. And he uses the examples of herds. He said these are the species that manage to propagate themselves, not the solitary individuals sort of clawing. And I think Kropotkin's got a lot to say, and he's right. Julian Bendo wrote a wonderful book called The Treason of Intellectuals. And it's about, you know, the selling out of the intellectual class to centers of power. And every university I've ever taught at, you know, everybody in the political science department or the Woodrow Wilson School is sort of, you know, begging to get some kind of a position in the State Department. And everything they write, I mean, all of their academic works becomes either advisory towards centers of power or actual attempts to seduce and placate centers of power. And this has just destroyed academic discourse in the United States. I do think it is better in Canada. Like economics departments in the United States, if you don't chant that mantra of laissez-faire capitalism, although it's completely discredited, you can't get tenure. And Benda says that we all have a choice as to what we can serve. We can serve privilege and power or justice and truth. But the closer you get towards those who serve privilege and power, the more you make concessions to those who serve privilege and power, the more you diminish your capacity to further the issues of justice and truth. And I think the failure of the left, certainly in the United States, is that we forgot. It's not our job to take power. That's not what we're here for. It's our job to hold fast to those moral imperatives of justice and truth and fight them. And in a sense, this is anarchist, that power is a corrupting force, no matter what your ideology is. And for those of us who care about an egalitarian society, we must constantly be alienated and antagonistic to all centers of power. And let me just throw in, as a seminary graduate, that for me, that is the core of the Christian gospel.
Thank you. We are now past 8:30, but I'm very aware that many people have been waiting in line to speak. And so what I'm going to suggest is that those who are willing to cede their place, understanding that we have to leave the room quite soon, if you're willing to do that, especially if you've just joined the line lately, I'd appreciate that. And otherwise, I'm going to ask those that are remaining in line to please be as brief as you possibly can, just so that we can hear the voices of those who want to say something, and then maybe we'll have a final word. So please go ahead.
First of all, thank you. Second of all, my question, I'm very curious to hear what everyone on this panel thinks about the most recent communique from Adbusters calling for a showdown in Chicago throughout the month of May of this year. And specifically, I'm curious to know, providing that you've all seen it, and I can only imagine that you have, what you think about the fact that it specifically references the 1968 Democratic Convention.
Thank you. Please go ahead, sir. Again, please be brief. Perhaps while you're working on that, I'll ask this person. They will come back to you, I promise, if you can get that turned on.
Should I go? I have a very specific question that I think can actually tie into the person before who was disillusioned and left. I did my undergrad in the States at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, in what I see as the beginnings of the rise of the Christian right, and this whole sort of movement towards, like, evil capitalism. And I see a deja vu in what is happening right now in Canada. And I would like to ask an American academic who understands this, if you could go back to that time frame and say, you know, if only we had done this differently, it might have, you know, changed X, Y, or Z. I think that would be an important lesson, possibly as something concrete that people involved in the movement who have lots of energy could take and use.
Thank you. Please go ahead now. I see you have your mic back.
Yeah. I want to address the complexity of societies. I want to know if, because as a member of the General Assembly over in Montreal, we tend to have some debates about the bureaucratization of the General Assembly, where we build up legal solutions to everything, and it becomes very complex to understand for people. So we tend to be on a dilemma where we seek efficiency and also accessibility. How should we address this kind of problematic?
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Very briefly, because except for one gentleman at the beginning who did a comment on French, we've forgotten the N-word, which is nationalism. And I'm wondering, because large entities don't necessarily are not exposed to that danger, how do smaller entities, geopolitical entities, in what you've been described as is coming and we all feel it, how can we prevent ourselves from being the victims of nationalism in the wrong hands?
Thank you. Thank you. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, Dick Gregory has mentioned, and I want to hear your comments on that, Mr. Chris, Ms. Hedges. Dick Gregory has mentioned that what is happening right now is pretty interesting and very dangerous for corporations, for the government of America, because the people that are protesting right now are children of people that have benefited from centuries of privilege. We're talking about white America. And so what's happening right now, so these are the sons and daughters that are asking for justice, as opposed to the minorities that fought in the civil rights movement. So I would like to know, I'm not sure about the that connection here, but I would like to know, is there room in the Occupy movement for consideration of ways to tackle the conditions that are allowing horrors like the genocide happening in Congo for minerals such as coltan, use for our iPad sales, etc., considering that two-thirds of the companies extracting minerals are Canadian. And the other question is, I just would like to have an update on the current status of your complaint filed against the Obama administration.
Okay, thank you. So we have one, two, and three, and then we'll allow our guest to have a final comment. You go ahead, sir.
Okay, my question is, it's my awakening today. It's the first time that I come to Occupy. Yeah. Ex-military also. My question is, now that I've woken up and I've seen that the system is corrupt, but I've always known that it was corrupt, but I thought I was stupid and depressive. How do we put a system in place where there's kind of support psychologically in terms of we've been programmed all our life to split, to stop communicating together, we've been brought up as machines. A lot of people, how do we put a system in place so we can change that? Because most people still live in the world where we're being tossed and bombed with all this information that's corrupting our minds. So how do we put a system in place so we can interact together and know that we're going and not going back to the same thing? Because Canada, why they followed the Americans is because we're fucking machines. Even though it happened, we just recreated it without even thinking about it. So how do we change this? This is what's important.
Thanks and welcome.
En tant que personne d'occupation Montréal, I was full-time at the occupation, and I wonder how come there's so many people here that look interested, and we're not so many at the foundry, Foundry Darling. So my question is how to get all these people tomorrow at the Foundry Darling at 7:45, the real people interested to join the movement and do.
Thank you.
7:45 or 7:45 Ottawa, au coin de Queen.
Thank you. Thank you. And are you waiting too? Please go ahead. Are you waiting too? Okay, so we'll have these last two very briefly, please.
So, hi, everyone. I'm up here because I wanted to speak a little, or really kind of bring out the topic of white democracy. I'm Filipino. I come from an ethnic minority community that right now in Montreal and in different places in North America have found North America to be a safe haven from so much corrupt government in the Philippines. Now our community is here coming, a majority coming through the Living Caregiver Program, which is really part of the neoliberal agenda of Canada and whatever. Anyway, so we come here as domestic workers, and right now what I would like to question and bring out is the involvement of these ethnic communities who right now are in our communities and are in fear of, you know, our youth are being criminalized, and, you know, just kind of being out there making a stand with this Occupy movement. I know that in the Filipino newspapers it has been out there that, you know, it's been publicized, yeah, Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street has been there, but the political involvement of the Filipino community, or I can't speak of other ethnic communities, but it's not publicized, and they don't feel involved. Now, my question to you is: how do you feel about having the ethnics being involved in the Occupy movement?
Thank you. Thank you very much. And this is our last question from the floor.
It's for any of you in your interactions or work with police. I was wondering if you get the sense that there is sort of the idea that police realize that they need to come at movements like Occupy from a different perspective, if there's like this idea of reform needed, or if it's just more like really on the defensive and not willing to look at things from a different angle.
Thank you. I'm going to invite last word from our panelists. We'll just go very briefly down the row here. Okay,
I'm going to try and speak again to inclusivity. And just say that two things. One, I think we need to be really careful about fetishizing process at the same time as it's good that there's a focus on process and that there can be a diversity of processes. And GAs can go on, but there can also be all sorts of other things that are going on. And I think that I think that the neighborhood occupies are a good thing. I think that whether or not we call it Occupy, let's organize our neighborhoods, let's organize around the workplaces we're in, let's organize from where we are situated. And I think also to turn your question on to the predominantly white activists who are in Occupy and particularly are remaining in Occupy, is how do we as white Occupy protesters make our spaces more conducive to other ethnic and other kinds of communities, and that is going to mean things like not always holding meetings in a place that isn't that accessible for people to get to. It's going to mean going into other communities, and it's going to mean really doing that work of outreach. And there are a lot of people in this room that are involved in community organizing that are not necessarily part of the Occupy camps, and I really, really encourage from all sides for you guys to talk to each other.
Thank you. Patrick?
For me, I guess I'll just take the showdown in Chicago sort of question. And I mean, even the alliteration alone tells you that this will be sort of a battle with and through the media, and hopefully turning more towards activist media. I mean, these types of events provide sort of something to organize around. They're sort of a symbolic sort of event that people can plan for. And in many senses, it's the global justice movement turned upside down, right? Because that movement was based and built around summit mobilizations. I was organizing demonstrations against the 2002 Kananaskis G8 summit in Calgary. But the issues we were mobilizing around was around IMF restructuration, third world debt, and things like that. And what we're seeing now, it's turned on its head, right? People are mobilizing for national issues at these international events. And so I think, and also in solidarity with global crises such as climate change that we're all facing. So I think it's another moment for people to mobilize around, to organize solidarity actions, and another opportunity to try and occupy people's imagination and work towards change.
Thank you, Patrick. Nathalie.
Yeah, well, my role here is probably to, I'll take the issue of the police, and I'll take also the issue of status and inclusivity. What we have found in Toronto, I think, is that although the movement was quite inclusive, the question of immigration status creates different types of vulnerability. And you can get deported if you're not a permanent resident and you're... So that created a different... a new vulnerability that had to be addressed. Certainly, I think we have challenged this. We have challenged the way in which people had been targeted because of their immigration status and so on. So I think there, but it was certainly an issue that had to be confronted. And on the police, I think what I said earlier is... police are a complex organization, and there are certainly within the policing there are groups, there are people that are sympathetic. They can't say it, but they are, and then there are the people that are told from the top to play the role. So I think to the question of how do they move away, I think it's too early to tell at this stage whether there's... that. I don't think that that's where they are now. But... I think Chris's message was eventually the pillars dissolve from the bottom. And they're certainly, it's surprising to me. I was very much involved in the Toronto area. We saw civil servants that were quite, if not actively participating, certainly trying to help out in some way. So I think that feeds the message, I think, that of tonight is ne pas arrêter le et de continuer.
Chris.
Well, I'm going to be in Chicago, and you should be there too. The police are going to do horrible things. This isn't a question so much of morality, although I think finally nonviolence is moral. It's a question of effective tactics. And as the movement grows, they will be called upon to use harsher and harsher measures of control. And the essence is to contaminate the police, to make them understand that we are representing their interests and that we don't carry out violence. Look, the Russian Revolution was a nonviolent revolution. The abdication of the Tsar was caused by nonviolence. The armed putsch came later by the Bolsheviks to crush the anarchists, the Soviets, in essence. And most successful revolutions are caused by the internal collapse of decayed regimes. Violence is just what they want. They know how to speak that language. This is driving them insane. In terms of the Christian right, I spent 2 years, you know, embedded within the Christian right all around the country, and wrote my book, American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. I was trying to reach out to them. I came to the conclusion that arguing with them is a waste of time. You can't argue with people who think that all living beings and animals were created 6,000 years ago. There's a gigantic $23 million creation museum in Peterborough, Kentucky, I went to, where the people who do the animatronic figures for Universal had come out to recreate the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve in a fake waterfall, naked, but, you know, Eve turns so no one can see her plastic breasts, of course. And a T-Rex with a saddle on it because they used to ride the dinosaurs, and the guide is taking us through and saying, well, I'm sure you all wonder why T-Rex has such big teeth when in the Garden of Eden there were no carnivores. Well, that's because Adam and Eve used T-Rex to open the coconuts. Then we went to the next room where there was a replica of Noah's Ark, and the guide was telling us, well, I'm sure you all wondered, how did Noah get the dinosaurs on the ark? Well, Noah only put baby dinosaurs on. It's all funny here, but when you're with a group of people who believe it, it's really terrifying. And the fact is, what drove, I mean, you know, and somebody call me an American academic, please, I'm not an academic. There's no university that would ever hire me as a full-time professor in America anyway. The fact is, what drives people into the embrace of this non-reality-based belief system is despair. And all of the great writers on totalitarianism, Hannah Arendt, Karl Popper, Fritz Stern, even Paxton as Anatomy of Fascism, they all talk about despair. And the fact is, and I learned all this by being with these people, and I spend the first chapter of their book telling their stories of financial dislocation and sexual abuse, because when communities physically break down, then families break down. And my heart went out. I don't think you can read those stories and not, and I came to have a tremendous amount of empathy for the people, the base of the movement, and a deep hatred for the people who run it. Who, for them, it's just a business. I actually debated McVitie at the University of Toronto once. The fact is, the only way to reincorporate these people within the society is to give them a job. It's to give them hope. It's to give them self-esteem. And we won't break the back of the Christian right until we re-enfranchise the working class back into the economy. That is the engine of this movement, as is the engine of all totalitarian movements. And I think what's frightening is that this unholy alliance between these, in essence, fascists. I mean, Hannah Arendt writes about in all totalitarian movements you have systems of propaganda and systems of indoctrination. So when you go to the mega churches and sit in the comfortable chairs and hear the music, and that's propaganda. But what most of people on the outside don't see are how once you're sucked in and taken to the creationist seminar and it becomes indoctrination, that it becomes cult-like because you have white male figures in these churches with tens of thousands of people who are in direct contact with God, who can't be questioned. People are separated from their families. You read the book, but so I don't have to go into it, but it's heartbreaking. I mean, all of their spiritual time, educational time is swallowed by these organizations, and they don't have any contact with husbands or children who aren't saved, and it's a great destroyer of family. I mean, when you look internally in these movements, they're very, very dangerous and very, very frightening and very powerful because these tens of millions of Americans are, in essence, hermetically sealed within Christian radio and television from the rest of the wider society. It's a very frightening movement, and as the situation deteriorates economically, the movement will grow. And fascism, unlike communism, always is about an alliance between retrograde capitalists and a party, and it's often a very uneasy alliance. But you see that, Dick Cheney doesn't have any time for the Christian right, but you see an alliance between these figures, and the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party is sort of illustrating that. I'm sort of forgetting the other questions.
Well,
the only thing I just want to say about China, somebody asked about China.
I think we're going to lose the room, but please go ahead, but perhaps quickly.
Don't buy their junk, okay? That's quick. And the other thing about the case is that we're finding out who the judge is in the Southern District Court of New York. They have a good record on civil liberties issues. If we get a judge we think is open to the case, we will ask for immediate litigation so that we can put an injunction against the law, which is slated to go into effect in March. The lawyers think that they have a pretty good chance of getting it to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court is packed with corporate clones. Thanks.
Thank you all. Thanks to all of you, and thanks again to our panel. Please go carefully and please continue.